Welcome to Finding Joy with Kara. I am your host, Kara Kavinsky. Today I'm speaking with Catherine Bertine. She is the author of Stand, a powerful memoir on activism, and it also serves as a how-to manual for progress. She created and produced the documentary Half the Road, which shines a massive spotlight on the inequalities of women's professional cycling. She is the founder of the Homestretch Foundation, a nonprofit in Tucson, Arizona, that provides temporary housing and other resources for professional athletes who face financial and economic discrepancies. I am thrilled to share our conversation. I'm so excited to see you, Catherine Bertine, and I have so much to ask you today on Finding Joy with Kara. I'm so grateful you're able to join me, so thank you.
Thank you, Kara. I'm very excited to be here on your inspirational show. Thank you for having me.
There are so many things that are inspiring about you. I don't know where to start. A writer, filmmaker, former professional figure skater, professional cyclist, and there's lots of other attributes and things that I can share. I saw you on Facebook. So I saw a post that you presented on Facebook with this equal sign that you held up at the start of a race in France. And I would love for you to explain that. And then let's rewind a bit to when you were a young girl.
Okay. So the specific equal sign that I held up happened to be in Italy, not France, but close enough.
Okay.
That's okay. This was back in 2013, and it was my second year racing as a professional cyclist. And at World Championships, I created an equal sign, you know, about 2 feet long by 1 foot high, like kind of roughly like the dimensions of a poster or half a poster. And it was my way of being able to say, hey, women deserve equal coverage and equal opportunity at races, especially specifically in cycling, where usually our races are half the distance of men and really marginalized into a sideshow treatment, especially on media platforms. So I knew that the one tiny chance I had to kind of voice my opinion, even if silently, was when every athlete who races at the World Championships goes to what's called the sign-in stage. And we officially sign in that we're taking the start line and we stand on the stage where the press can take a photo, right? So I did that. And in that pause, being up there standing in front of the crowd, that's when I held up the equal sign. And people in the crowd are Italians and are cycling fans. They seem to appreciate it. Whether or not they knew what it stood for, they were cheering, which was really lovely. And a wonderful pro photographer took a photo and sent it to me. And so that's the image that you saw in that.
Which
photo
is the cover for your book, the most recent memoir, Stand, which I love how you describe it as a roadmap for activism, as well as a personal memoir. Back in kindergarten, when you were 6 years old, your bike chain fell off and you fixed it. And in your class, in your kindergarten class at the age of six, you wrote very legibly, "I want to be a fix-it woman."
That is correct. Yeah. I lived very close to where I went to school. So it's normal to ride your bike to school. And I guess during that journey, the chain fell off and I was able to figure out how to put it back on, which in my six-year-old mind was like the coolest thing ever. Like I felt like I unlocked a secret of the universe with my dirty little hands. I was like, oh, it works again. And I think later that day, it was the teacher who had an assignment for us and had asked, like, write down what you want to be when you grow up. And I have a feeling she meant this more as a handwriting assignment than a moral exploration of where you wanted your life to go. But inspired by the fact that my bike chain fell off and I figured out how to put it back on, it was very clear to me that, of course, I want to be a fix-it woman.
And you clarified it with, I want to fix broken things.
Yes.
Well, you certainly found something broken to fix, which is equality in women's cycling. But before you got there, and so let's start back when you were a child, you engaged in figure skating.
I have to say that even before figure skating, I have wonderful parents who just wanted me to play. play sports and or play anything. They just want to play outside. And clearly my genetic code loved playing all things sports, and they just exposed me to things. For example, I don't remember learning how to swim or to skate or to ski, which is, you know, something we do in cold climates. And I grew up in suburban New York, where there are plenty of small ski mountains within an hour's drive, right? So I don't remember learning how to do any of those things, which tells me that's how early I was exposed to those sports, right? And so because we lived 5 minutes away from a skating rink, I wanted to go. And I remember that we had an after-school program where every Monday from 3 to 5, our town could go and skate. All the kids could go skate. And so I just remember looking forward, like, is it Monday yet? Is it 3 o'clock yet? And again, I played all the other school sports that you can think of, soccer and running and everything but ballet. I was a big tomboy, and ballet did not, tutus didn't work for me. But I was exposed to that. That was there. If you want to try ballet, go ahead. So long story short, yeah, I just developed this love of being on the ice, and I got into figure skating and started, I mean, I knew how to skate since childhood, but I started taking lessons around 11. And the allure of that sport just sunk its hooks in me. Even though I didn't like the dresses and the sequins, I was like, okay, fine. If I have to wear that, I love the athletic side of this sport. And, you know, soon I grew out of the tomboy years and wanted to actually wear those dresses with sequins. But, you know, I loved the journey of it, and also loved running. And I got into, you know, track and cross country when I was in high school. So it was really about running and skating. And I was able to do both of those things, again, because of proximity to a rink and how close I lived to school. I could do both of those sports. And so that was the journey in skating. And I knew that I wasn't quite going to make the Olympic team, probably started a bit too late and didn't quite have enough talent, but I had enough talent to get to the professional ranks, things like the Icecapades, Disney on Ice, Holiday on Ice. And I recognized too how cool it would be to tour the world and see different countries and different places. So I auditioned for the Icecapades as a senior in high school, and I got in, but I also very much wanted to go to college. And Icecapades said, go to college. We prefer taking skaters who are a little bit older, more mature. And I said, great. So I went to college, where I still kept skating. And also, while I didn't continue running, I got into rowing, which was my dad's sport. And he always said, try rowing. And I tried out for the team. So I was a rower and a skater, all things connected to water in some way. And that was, yeah, that was the journey.
So, and you grew up in Bronxville, New York.
Bronxville, New York.
And so you had all these amenities and a rink nearby. And then you went to Colgate.
Yeah, Colgate University in upstate New York, about 4 hours north of where I live, which felt very foreign, you know, going 4 hours away from home. So yeah, that's where I went. That's where I rode and I skated. And then I toured professionally in skating for a year after college. But in college, I discovered my love of writing, of journalism, specifically nonfiction. These were, you know, just there's something that spoke to me about writing. And that's where I really got into the craft. And I found that one of the best writing schools was University of Arizona in Tucson. And so I applied there for my MFA in nonfiction. And after my skating year, I traveled out to Tucson, where there was neither ice nor water, not in the desert. And my athletic side said, well, you got to find something to do, you know, just you got to move around. What's it going to be? And some of my rowing friends said, oh, you got to get a bike. Got to get a bike. It's the same muscle groups as rowing as well as skating. I was like, oh, okay. And there was a club triathlon team that you could join as a grad student. And I did that. I jumped into the tri world and I fell equally in love with that as I did with skating and rowing. So for about 5 years, I progressed through the amateur ranks of triathlon, and I had an opportunity to see how far can I take this. And 5 years later, yeah, I turned professional in triathlon, but was always a middle of the pack level pro. It wasn't like I was on the Wheaties box. So, you know, but it was during that time too that it became clear to me that out of the three disciplines of triathlon, swimming, cycling, and running, I was the strongest in cycling. So eventually I transitioned from triathlon into road cycling. And that is when the proverbial curtain was pulled back in terms of fairness and equality. And those were not things that I had paid attention to in the other sports that I played, because, you know, running or skating or rowing, I saw boys and men around all the time. We had equal access to boats and to ice rinks and to tracks. And in triathlon too, men and women ran or competed in the same distance. The pros had the exact same prize purse for men and women. So to me, to step into the world of cycling, it was almost like getting launched back into the 1700s or 1800s, because now I'm in this sport where women race half the distance. We weren't even allowed to all the events. They didn't have a women's field. And then for the events where professional women were allowed and had an equal race opportunity, the prize purse was and is pennies on the dollar compared to the men. And that's where my inner journalist started asking, why? Why? Why is it like this? And there were no answers, or no, definitely no good answers. So I started thinking, okay, if I can get to the pro ranks as a cyclist, and if I'm working in journalism, then I could use my voice as a journalist and a pro athlete to try to affect change. So let me see if I can do that. And of course, as I was thinking that, I was working part-time as a waitress, and I was still very much an amateur cyclist, and I was trying to do everything I could to get to the pro ranks. But as a journalist, this was also around 2008 and 9, and there was a big economic crisis happening, and so it was tough to be a freelance writer at that point. I'd been working for ESPN and then didn't have a current contract, and things changed a little bit in 2011 when I was offered a staff position at ESPN as a writer and an editor. So I was like, okay, I've got the journalism box checked off. Now about that pro contract in cycling. And that brought me to 2012. I was 37 years old in 2012. And that's considered ancient in cycling because there was this archaic rule where in women's pro cycling, teams cannot average over the age of 28.
And how many are on a team?
Oh, that depends. It can be, let me phrase it this way. 6 women race in an event on a team. So teams could be anywhere from as little as 6 to as many as 14. The higher level teams will keep a roster of 12 to 14 because then they've got 2 squads that they can send out to various races. And they've got 2 alternates who can sub in for people who are injured or burnt out or need a break. So I like to think that the best teams have between 12 and 14, but that doesn't mean that it has to be that number.
So when were you doing the ESPN coverage where they were filming you going after an Olympic spot on the team that was going to be the London Olympics, I believe?
Yes, actually, that was the Beijing Olympics in 2008.
Okay.
You know, I was given an assignment from 2006 to 2008, shortly before the market crash. The ESPN assignment was see if you can get to the Olympics, pick a sport, go. That's when I transitioned from triathlon to cycling. That's really what hooked me into the sport of road cycling. And ESPN, during that 2-year journey, they covered all of the bases of training, which makes such a huge difference. Imagine if you don't have to worry about paying for entry fees or traveling to a race. You know, that made such a difference. And I wrote about that in As Good as Gold, which is the book that was my second of 4 books. And that journey was just something really incredibly special and amazing. And then after that assignment ended, and spoiler alert, I didn't make it to the Olympics, which is a really good thing because I don't think anybody can or should just be like, oh, I want to go to the Olympics. And then all of a sudden, 18 months later, there they are. You know, this actually was an expose of how hard it is to qualify. And what had happened was I didn't qualify, but I came so close. And that's what really made the passion, you know, kick in for me of like, maybe I can get there in the future. One of the things that I discovered on that quest to try to get to 2012 games was that there are some sports where it's not just about talent, but about qualification procedures that could potentially be very, very out of date. And that's what really was illuminated in the world of cycling. It's one thing, say in running or in swimming, where you have to meet a certain time standard and you go and whoever is the fastest that day in Olympic trials goes, right? That's great. That's how it should be. But in cycling, there is this very convoluted way of points. And not everybody is allowed to go to every race. It's a system that keeps the wealthier countries in line and in charge of who's qualifying. And also only half of the women are allowed in the Olympics as the men are for cycling. Yeah.
You're kidding. So,
Oh, no, no. Apparently, this is supposed to change by 2024, but it has taken its sweet time in cycling. And it's something like 64 women and double that of men.
The trials and tribulations, literally, of that entire journey were insane and continued to be. But you coined the term Almostian. And I love that.
I'm a proud Almostian. And, you know, and I think that people really, everybody who goes out and tries to achieve something, that is the win. You know, I think that we could all be proud Almostians if we can remove that fear of like, well, what if I don't make it? You know, is it worth it if I shoot for something and I don't make it? And the answer is, of course it's worth it. Like the experiences that you learn and the amazing journey of what happens, that's always worth it. You know, especially when you connect and interact with other people, other cultures. And in this case, for me, the entire paradigm of equality that came into view. It's one thing if you don't make the Olympics because you don't meet the physical standard. But imagine if you can't get there because of roadblocks that are so antiquated and outdated that other people are selected for the games who might not be your level, you know?
Well, and you are what Catherine Switzer is to marathon running, you are to cycling, without a doubt. And if anyone doubts this, they need to, one, not only read your book, Stand, but two, watch your documentary, Half the Road, to illuminate the issues and talk about how that came about, just briefly, because that's what the book's about, you know, like a good chunk of it, not all of it, but a good chunk of it. I just want to interject something too. In reading your book, which I read in its entirety very carefully, I deleted my ESPN app by page 47. I was exhausted halfway through the book for you. I was exhausted. And I was only halfway through. I'm like, what else could this woman go through? I was like, oh my God, are you kidding me? And you encountered other women that you reference as sister block. You describe this as a verb to stop other women from rising. There's no place in society for people like that. There just isn't.
Oh my gosh, Kara, thank you. You give me a lot to unpack here, but I first have to start with thank you for the kind words of comparing me to Catherine Switzer. She's a hero of mine, and what she did for women in the marathon is amazing. And the fact that now she and I are friends because she was in the film Half the Road, which I created. Half the Road is a story about women's professional cycling, not just the pitfalls that we face, but really the power of the sport and the people and the amazing women who are part of this. It's not a film at all about myself. I do jump in to narrate here and there, but it's really about the beautiful journey of female pro athletes in cycling. And when I was working with ESPN and I said, hey, ESPN, your 30 for 30 series is thriving. It's huge. You don't have enough film on women pro athletes. And also now that I'm a pro cyclist myself, I have access to some of the greatest athletes and the coolest characters. And I could make a documentary that illuminates not just these amazing athletes, but the incredible sport itself. And the woman who was basically my boss at ESPN at the time, she didn't say no politely. She pretty much smacked it down, you know, saying, well, cover your ears, Catherine, but does anybody even watch women's cycling? And I remember thinking in that moment, the reason nobody watches women's cycling is because you don't put it on TV. That's why. But you're ESPN and you have the power to flip that switch. And FYI, cycling is huge across the rest of the world. And it brings in lots of viewership and in turn, lots of revenue from that viewership, right? So yes, I understand that it's not as visible in the US. We pretty much only have access to the Tour de France visibly. But imagine the untapped potential here, especially when I can show all the amazing characters in this sport. So she shot that down. And it, for me, internally flipped the switch of, you know what? I'm going to make this film anyway. I can't tell you where that drive and desire comes from, but it was something that my heart and brain really kind of got together and said, no, this film needs to happen. So that was 2012, really, when I decided to see, okay, I said out loud, okay, I'm going to make this film. And then I was like, oh shit, now I have to actually find out how to make a film and where am I going to get the funding to make this happen? That's where the power of connection and the world really stepped forward and completely crowdsourced this on Indiegogo, which is a competitor of Kickstarter. And 16 different countries, an equal split of men and women, came up with the entire budget to shoot this film. And we're talking about $77,000, two rounds of fundraising. And to me, to somebody who was working as a waitress at that point and a highly underpaid pro cyclist, $77,000 could have had three zeros on the end of it. You know, I was like, oh my God, we can do this. We can make this happen. And I partnered up with a professional cinematographer, Kevin Tokstad. So I was able to use my writing skills to write the narrative, but I sure as heck needed help with actually creating the film. And that's where, again, that's where teamwork makes things happen, right? And group work, because it was really the world that said, we want to see this film and we stand behind you. So the film took about 2 years to film, to edit, and to get to the place where we could launch it. And what I love about, you know, the triumph of the underdog here is that when we premiered Half the Road in January of 2014, and we did that in Tucson at a 500-seat theater, and it sold out immediately. And I don't know 500 people in Tucson, so it was amazing. It wasn't just friends and family, you know, it was strangers, but they were drawn to the plot of it. And from that point, we were able to gain international distribution. We then entered, I feel like we were accepted by 10 film festivals, three of which we won. And screenings across the world were happening. To this day, I still get royalty checks, even if they're small. I still get royalty checks from a film that ESPN said no one would watch.
I love that. And you expose in this a really antiquated culture, like you said. When you stepped into cycling, it was like stepping back in the 1700s. And I'm grateful you didn't need to wear some sort of corset and, you know, something while you had to go into cycling. But I had no idea. And having a daughter who played Division I soccer and rowing, I've really been attached to FIFA. We've attended a Women's World Cup, not gone to a men's, but Women's World Cup in Germany. And expose my kids to that. But I didn't realize that the UCI was as corrupt as FIFA. Mm. And also today is Equal Pay Day, hashtag Equal Pay Day. Megan Rapinoe testified on Capitol Hill today. And with the recent discrepancy between the NCAA, which is headquartered here in Indianapolis, between the men's and women's basketball, and they don't apply the branding March Madness to the women, only the men. So there are all of these different things that are coming about throughout all of these different sports that kids can't even conceptualize that there's not equality to a decent degree. And I think it's ridiculous we're still having this conversation on the professional level where women can clearly kick ass. Everyone knows who Abby Wambach is and knows who Megan Rapinoe is. And that women's professional soccer team, our Olympic team, and just what they are doing helps lift your tide, right? A rising tide raises all ships. So all of this is helping across. And it's just ironic that we're having this conversation today on Equal Pay Day. I didn't know that till right when we started talking and looked up that tweet from Megan about the testimony today.
It's so true. You know, the rising tide is what we're really going to need to change this antiquated culture. And that is when cycling and soccer and ice hockey and the WNBA, you know, when all of these, and those are just four sports, and we know there are many more, but when we can work together to remind people that, look, creating change for women's cycling isn't about women's cycling. It's about the rising tide so that we get to that place where everybody will eventually receive equal pay. And of course, that comes with equal exposure. You know, I love when all the mansplainers and the trolls are like, well, women don't have equal pay because they don't generate a large enough audience. And I'm like, right. And who do you think is controlling that audience? It's the people who are not putting it on TV or visual platforms that we have. They're not streaming it in any capacity. We're still reduced to that sideshow event. You know, when's the last time you saw a women's sport broadcast at 7 p.m. or 8 p.m. prime time? Right?
Right.
Never.
Right.
And so that is where the change really has to take place and has to happen, is that those who are pulling the strings, not pulling the strings, but actually setting the motion in play of visibility and viewership, there are people making those decisions. And if they try to say, oh, well, you know, there's no viewership for this, that's a cop out. It's because they've not given us the platform to create a viewership, right?
Right. And, exactly. And yeah. So with Half the Road and your push, one of the big things with cycling, most everyone knows Tour de France. And so you were poised at a perfect time. So you had, the men are plagued by the doping scandals, mm-hmm. typically, and now it's super common, which is awful, but the women don't have those issues. So you're uniquely postured to press forward for La Course by Tour de France. When was that inaugural event? When did the women actually get a road race in France for that? And what's the length of it now? And what's going to happen this year with it?
Yeah. So Tour de France, again, like you talked about March Madness, the actual name Tour de France is branded, right? So one of the things that we were up against in this push for women to be at the Tour de France was the fact that back in the 80s, and then even for 2 years in the 50s, there were events at the Tour de France for women. And then they fell by the wayside in 1989, specifically from 1984 to 89, there was a women's Tour de France that ran on the same day in conjunction with the men's. And in 89, it went away and it disappeared. And the reason was that broadcasting started happening, international televised broadcasting. And for the race directors at the Tour de France, they had a choice. They said, great, we'll include the women too. We'll showcase two different races. And they didn't. They got rid of the women. And the women's race director was like, well, okay, well, we'll make our own women's Tour de France and we'll have it a couple weeks later. We'll create our own Tour de France. And ASO, the parent company of the Tour de France, said, nope, you can't have the rights to the name Tour de France. Those are ours. And sure enough, they weren't, the women's field wasn't able to secure the sponsorship that it needed to continue the race with the name Tour de France. We talked about the concept of sister blocking, of holding women back with the knowledge that that's what they were doing, even though these were men, not women in this case, holding the women back. That was something that transpired over, you know, throughout the 80s and the 90s and the majority of the 2000s. So when I was making Half the Road, I had the opportunity to connect with some of the biggest names in the sport. And for us, Marianne Vos and Emma Pooley were the Gretzky's and the Michael Jordans, you know, for cycling. And Marianne still is. So these were huge names. And also Chrissy Wellington, of the same recognition in triathlon. When they all felt the same way I did, that women should be at the Tour de France, I said, you know what, maybe now we can band together and create that rising tide and target the ASO for change. And we did. We launched a petition on change.org back in 2013 to enable us to sit down with ASO and create a race for women. And what was awesome was that this is in the earlier days, by the way, of change.org. It's a lot easier now to just kind of click, sign in, sign a petition. Back then, you needed to enter a lot of data, and it wasn't easy to just rally the troops to get signatures, but we did. And about 100,000 people signed on.
One of the best little juicy details in your book about that process was who you decided to have copied every time someone signed that petition.
Oh, yes. So change.org has this box that you can check if you want the recipient of this petition to receive an email every time the petition is signed. Check here. And of course, we were targeting, you know, the head honcho at ASO and the race director of the Tour de France, Christian Prudhomme. And so I was like, well, yeah, I'm going to check that box. Of course I am. And back then I was thinking, maybe we'll get 100 signatures. Maybe we'll get 1,000. So you can imagine my surprise and ultimate joy when we got nearly 100,000 signatures and became one of change.org's most successful petitions of 2013.
I just the mental image of somebody being so pissed off about their inbox being flooded by this.
Oh, he was pissed off because, you know, from the book, when we finally fast forwarding, we did achieve this mission of sitting down to a meeting with ASO. The very first words he said in the start of the meeting was what I refer to as the great finger wag, you know, where he kind of shook his finger at us like you would a toddler who spilled their milk. You know, he shook a finger and said, you should not have started that petition. you should not have done that petition. And we kind of suppressed a smile and said, well, you know, he was like, you should have reached out another way. But I had tried many times individually and as a group to reach out, and we heard crickets. We heard nothing back. So that's why we went with the petition. And Emma Pooley was the one who said, well, you know, well, luckily the petition worked and here we are. So let's get on with the meeting, you know, but that we were disciplined, you know, was it just made us giggle and also made us feel like, wow, we really are back in the 1800s now. So,
right.
Well, but and check the box, you know, check the box.
That's a lesson right there. Definitely check the box. during that time, you talk about the passive aggressive must be nicers. And being a professional athlete is so difficult, let alone the lack of money, earning whatever, and also trying to enact change and create a vehicle to market this message out to the world, which is the documentary Half the Road. And like you said, it's really not about you. You just were the driving force behind it. It is a lot of coverage of all of these different stakeholders in this play. So I love how someone said to you, must be nice to race your bike and make movies. Like, this is a glamorous whatever. And you were going through some really difficult times, super difficult, which we can talk about in a moment. And your response was, yes, it is nice to professionally bike race and filmmake at the to expose injustice and fight for equal opportunity. What did you do at work today? I love that. And there's been some fun ripple effects of this, but you reached a decently low point. And I respect your vulnerability for sharing this in the book. And Stand is a bit of a roller coaster. And it seems like just as you get to a pinnacle, you get knocked back. It's like a couple steps forward, couple steps back, just with qualifying for a race, just with getting points added to your record professionally to qualify you for something else. And you've gone to such amazing lengths and you've been surrounded by miracles, ordinary and extraordinary miracles that have kept you on the rails. And I'd love for you to share a little bit of that, because you really went through some tough stuff.
I did. And I, you know, something that you just said, really, I think it's such a beautiful way to look at this, ordinary and extraordinary miracles. I really kind of grasped onto when you said ordinary miracles. And I think you're surrounded by people that we don't know care so much about who we are or what we believe or what we stand for, or maybe just close friends that we haven't seen or connected with. Maybe for some of us in a more public setting, maybe it's just complete strangers, but there are so many ordinary miracles around us that can affect us. And we might not realize that unless we're willing to let them in. And when I say let them in, sometimes that means showing the vulnerability of what we're really going through.
Well, being open to receiving, like, yes, first identifying that that is a miracle and some validation that you're on the right path, but being open to receiving that, which is difficult for some people.
It's a fearful thing to put yourself out there and be open to what might come back. Because as we know, I got plenty of must be nicers, you know, and that's a scarring thing when people are either passive aggressive or just completely aggressive, especially in this modern day of social media. And they just might go at you and just try to take you down. That was, for me, that was always hurtful, because I too am a very sensitive person. Like, I don't need somebody stepping on my heart. No one does, right?
And I love how you put, direct honesty is kryptonite of passive aggressiveness.
Yes, yes, exactly. To be direct and to be honest is the best way that we can thwart people who are passive aggressive, and as much as we can too, to disassociate from them. Don't spend too much time trying to argue or convince them, but just to put them in a category and be like, yeah, you're going to the cheap seats of the friendship bleachers. You're not welcome down around my circle of people that I trust. And speaking of which, I think it's so important to keep your inner circle pretty small and tight. I have two or three friends that I'll check in with often, where if I'm going through something rough, or if I sense that they might be going through something rough. You know, keeping close tabs on a few people is something that can be a really magical experience of feeling like you are supported and you have somebody that you could call at 3 o'clock in the morning if you needed to. For me, it took a while to get to that point though, because while I was going through all of the journey of activism, and I still am in many ways, but it's exhausting to continuously put yourself out there. And I don't think I truly understood the level of support that I had until later. It's one thing to ignore the trolls, but it's another thing when activism really takes a big shark bite out of your personal life. And it did for me. So as we were getting so many incredible things happening in terms of equality and equity for women in pro cycling, my personal life one day completely shattered when my husband left very unexpectedly. And so now my marriage is just gone. And that's what's happening privately. Yet publicly, I had to put on this face of being a spokesperson for women's rights. And that is really what nearly broke me, was trying to be two different people at once, you know, falling apart privately, but publicly exuding strength and confidence. Mm-hmm. And looking back, would I make any changes? I can't say I would make any changes, because that was so raw and in the moment. And that's what I was processing at the time. But if I could ever offer any advice, it would be like, if you're ever in a position like that, don't put on two different faces. Find your way to just be who you are, be very authentic and natural, and also ask for help. That was the biggest thing. That's what I should have done originally and immediately, was be, you know, reach out and be like, I need some help. I'm falling off the rails here. And I don't know where that's going to lead or what that could mean. So that's one thing that I was definitely struggling with. And for the time frame, this was around 2014.
So you have this documentary at that time being mm-hmm. wrapped up, or just getting out there in the world.
It was out.
Yep. And dealing with that, which it had its own life, mm-hmm. right? So you let your baby out into the world, and then dealing with this on the personal level.
Oh yeah. I mean, there wasn't just the race, it wasn't just half the road, but La Course by Tour de France was something that we were creating that was going to take place. And I had my third book coming out at that time. So everything that professionally I was working for was falling into place. If you're in a healthy, strong relationship, that is when you want to rightfully assume that your person will be standing with you, right. You know, when all of your hard work has finally paid off. And I don't mean financially, you know, I was a female professional athlete and an independent filmmaker. It's not like I was rolling in dough, but everything that was happening that I was working for was happening. And that was extremely successful until my rock of support just vaporized and was no longer there.
You fortunately survived and made it through that without incident. And it was one of those miracles that I mentioned, and the timing.
Yeah. I think that particular journey is probably best left to Stan to kind of read through that part, because otherwise that could be potentially another hour.
Right. I know. Well, and it's worth reading. And I'll be honest, I cried through the last third, like bawled. And for whatever reason, that triggered with me good things, but things that I could relate to. And I am a memoirist, and with an up and coming book. And I was told before I started writing it that people connect with that 20% of that deeply personal part. And I didn't even want to write a memoir. I was just writing about other people. But it was only when I was convinced that I could help others that I decided to include my story. And yours resonated with me for the same reasons, because you're really helping other people and totally selfless. Yes, you're a professional athlete. That's a very internal, personal thing, but why you do it, what you're doing to encourage and inspire, and there's so many wonderful ripple effects that have happened as a result of your efforts, not just with Half the Road, but even just thinking of who you inspired with the 2 years with ESPN trying to become an Olympian. And this work has been so important for that fight for equality, and with La Course des Tours de France. Let's talk about some of the other global effects that you have incidentally had on the world. Dubai is one of them. Mm-hmm. A random woman that wanted a selfie with you at La Course de la Tour de France.
Right. And I should probably start by saying too, that we created La Course by Tour de France. We really made that race for ASO. We were the ones to create it and they took the credit, which is fine because at least we have the race. But I also like to say that because as we know, there are many women who are hidden figures. They're the ones who made stuff happen behind the scenes. To this day, if you were to go to the Tour de France website or La Course by Tour de France, you will see no mention of me, of Emma Pooley, of Marianne Vos, or Chrissy Wellington. We haven't been given any credit for it. And my ego is fine with that because there's a race at the Tour de France. That's what I wanted to have happen. I don't need my name attached to it, but I do think it's very interesting and important that ASO wanted it to be their idea, and they've never credited us for any part of making that happen. And so it's important that maybe whenever we see something groundbreaking and new that happens, look behind the scenes to think, how did this really happen? Who was involved? Who made this happen? I guarantee that if you ask those questions, you're going to find some amazing women that were in positions to make something pretty epic happen, but it might not be credited to them immediately. So go out there and turn over those stones and unearth what we can. So there's that. So.
Right. Well, which was a Herculean effort sense of the term.
It was. And the book will go into the details about how we did that and how we made that stuff happen. And also at that time, I was actually dropped from my team because I had that one director who didn't want me to be a rabble rouser for equality and for justice. And so I started the 2014 season without a team, even though I was at my best and my fittest and healthiest racing ever. And ultimately, a team, you know, ranked top 10 in the world, actually picked me up and brought me to La Course by Tour de France because I was a rabble rouser. They're like, we want you on our team. And how interesting that the team that I was on, they didn't even qualify. Oh, karma, right? So fortunate that I got to be there at the inaugural La Course. And during the race, there was a flat tire, which is very normal in bike racing. And I call it the greatest flat tire of my life because in that moment, I got to look around and actually see the crowd that was there, that, I mean, rows and rows of people deep who had come to watch the women's race many, many hours before the men would even cross the same streets. So that was huge. That was amazing to see. And then after the race, this young woman who at the time was nameless to me, I can't even remember if we exchanged names, but she said, I've been following your journey and what you do. And I'm from Chicago and I came out here to this race to watch it. And I just love to get a selfie. And I'm probably like in delirium from racing, but I was like, yeah, absolutely. And we took a selfie together. And little did I know that 4 years later, she would apply to be a resident at Homestretch Foundation, which is the foundation that I now run for women, for female pro cyclists and pro athletes who struggle with the gender pay gap. And this woman who at this point, of course, I knew her name, Daphne Karaganis, and she applied to Homestretch. She got here. And it was only many months later that she said, oh, by the way, I don't know if you remember this, but we took this photo together in France 4 years ago. And I was like, wait, that was you? You know, and later that year, she signed her first professional contract to race as an athlete. So that for me was huge. And it did go straight to the heart of the ripple effect that we might be creating that we don't even know is out there. And we need to own that to remember, even when we feel really low or really down, that there are people who are there in this rising tide who will help lift us and who we also lift without even knowing it. So I love that. Now Daphne is a great friend and we see each other at least once a year. So that's fantastic.
Yeah. And what's happening in Dubai? I was so surprised to read about that country and what they're doing.
Dubai is such an interesting place. There is a huge number of expatriates from other countries that live in Dubai. And then there's half of Dubai, of course, which is very much the local crowd that might be a little bit occasionally behind in women's rights. So it's such an interesting melting pot. And the Dubai story is really interesting. There was a woman, Pascal Dejong, who back in 2014 reached out to me and said, look, I'm a Dutch expat and I live in Dubai and I really want to bring Half the Road here for a screening. And I said, great. Okay. Here's the process for getting a screening. And she said, well, we're going to have to do something different because Dubai won't show any films that where the word gay or homosexual is used. And I said, no. And she said, could we edit out part of your film? And I flew off the handle. I was like, absolutely not. No, 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 no way. That's not happening. And I'm basically hanging up the phone with her. And she said, wait, 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 hear me out. I'm gay. And I said, what? This doesn't make any sense. Why would a gay woman in Dubai want to cut out the part of Half the Road where we talk about gay? And she said, I don't want to cut out that part. I just want to cut out one sentence where the character uses the word gay or homosexual. And I said, one sentence. And that's when she explained if that sentence is spoken, then they can't show the film. She said, but it's very obvious that this couple that you are interviewing is gay. It doesn't even need that word. It's very obvious. And what she did was exceptional. She made me question my absolute of no, of course, there are not going to be any edits to this. Being like, oh, now I see your perspective. And she said, by bringing it here, you can really educate the whole world and you can show your support of the gay community as well, just by omitting this one spoken word. And I was like, wow. So it was something else. Then, so we ended up screening in Dubai. They brought me out there for the screening halfway around the world. And what was amazing was the amount of people that came to the theater. Women's College was there. All sorts of cultures and different walks of life were there for that screening on a film of women cyclists. It was incredible. And then Pascal also took me to lobby for change with the officials, the fact that there was a men's tour of Dubai, but there wasn't a women's. And so we began that fight for a women's tour to Dubai. And Pascal warned me, she said, listen, this stuff takes a long time. So we're probably not going to get it this year. We might not even get it for 5 years, but it starts now and we'll keep working on it. I'm like, okay. So fast forward, that was November of 2014. Fast forward to November of 2020. And the first official women's tour of Dubai was held. And one of our athletes from the Homestretch Foundation was on a team that was asked to race at the Tour of Dubai. So talk about the ripple effect and how important it is to sometimes remember that you're right, not all change is going to happen overnight, but keep doing it, keep plugging away. And that's a huge victory. It was 6 years later, but it still happened and it's still happening. Barring COVID and all the weirdness of whether there's a race or not this year, that doesn't matter. It's still happening. It will happen, you know, fast forwarding again. So,
well, I hope that the ripple effects continue to happen. I hope that thousands of people read your book and are inspired and can apply the roadmap that you've provided in that towards other areas to work towards equality. And I'm so grateful to speak with you today and for your generous time in sharing your story. Thank you, thank you, thank you, Catherine, for all that you're doing.
Kara, thank you so much for having me on your show. I think you have such an amazing podcast and you're such an incredible conversationalist. So thank you very much, Kara, for all that you're doing.
Thank you for listening to Finding Joy with Kara. I hope this podcast inspires you and helps you along your own journey to finding joy.